Hi everybody, this is the Gingerbread Man again, and I'm here to express myself and to talk about some hopefully helpful and interesting topics. I would like to say good day to you, good night, good afternoon, good morning, whatever time of the week or whatever time of the day that you happen to be listening to. I'm just grateful that you're here. It means so much to me to have your ears and to have your attention right now, to have my voice go through these wires and into your headphones and into your brain. Is so fortunate a capability for us nowadays, you know, through our technology and through the interconnectedness and how small our world has become. I'm so lucky to be able to reach out and to speak to all of you. And I just want you to know how lucky I feel. It's been a crazy couple weeks. I'll get into it more, but the stresses and the pressures of the past couple weeks is kind of what helped formulate the topic and the idea for this episode this week. Maybe you'll see that. But before we get into it, I think we should start by having a message from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Presence. Presence is affiliated with Awareness and Mindful Acknowledgement. You can get presence free by embracing the moment. The most present and precious space we make day to day is the home. How we make our home and the love that we pour into it. You can go out and find your own presence today. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about home. What is home? A couple little quotes just to help consider it. Pliny the Elder, who is also known as Gaius Plinius Secundus, he did his living and talking in the first century AD, approximately 79-ish. And I got most of these quotes off of bravequotes.com. It's a quote website that does like quote images. I don't know if you've seen my webpage, but I try to make these kind of quote images. It's hard to call them memes because they're not really that catchy or funny. It's just a quote on the background of hopefully an appealing image that makes it a little bit more palpable. So this is where I got most of these quotes. So Pliny the Elder, he says, and I'm sure you've heard this one before, home is where the heart is. Which I liked. Laura Ingalls Wilder, who is the author of Little House on the Prairie, and she did most of her writing in the beginning of the 20th century, she said, home is the nicest word there is. Maya Angelou, okay, don't bone me, she was a civil rights activist and a poem writer and an author, and she did plays. She was just an overall badass of a creative person and a woman. She said, the ache for home lives in all of us, the safe place where we can go as we are and not be questioned. And Rodney Dangerfield, who is a comedian who passed away in the early 2000s, did a lot of comedy in the 80s and the 90s, he said, a girl phoned me the other day and said, come on over. There's nobody home. I went over and nobody was home. So people have been talking about home, this concept of home, for a really, really, really long time, I feel like. It might be one of the most human concepts that we all share. And I feel you could talk about home with anybody, except for somebody who's been incredibly disparaged and hasn't been allowed to have access to a concept of home, you know? And there's many different types of homes. There's different styles of being in a home. We can make a home on a street corner. There are people who choose to not have brick and mortar for their settling to put their head down. You know, some people choose not to have a physical home. But I would hazard to say that emotionally, within a context, they have a concept of a home, even if the world is their home at that point. Diogenes, the Greek philosopher who I've spoken about several times on the show, He only owned a blanket and a bowl. And he got rid of his bowl when he saw a child drinking water with his hands. And he's like, oh, if I can use my hands, then I don't need this bowl either. So within his cynical philosophy, he was trying to get rid of all of these things. And all he needed was a blanket, because he would sleep on the ground wherever he could. He would sleep, you know, on stoops, but he slept outside and he moved with the seasons. And I think and feel that he was at home no matter where he was at. It's the concept, you know? But we've had these physical buildings for a very, 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 very long time. Using a couple websites, including Wiki and, gosh, I didn't even write it down. My bad. I didn't cite too well for this episode, but I'm just talking about generals. So I found some information about what's called the Oldupai or the Olduvai Gorge, which is in Tanzania. Gosh. It has structures, footprints, and apparent, at least, evidence of some sort of archaeological curiosity dating back to 1.8 million years ago, which could mean that the structures that were built could have been done by something that were not Homo sapien, because many archaeologists, holy crap, I'm all over the place today. But many archaeologists would say that the Homo sapien that we know of only goes back 200, 250,000 years max. You know, a lot of Vedic scripture and a lot of Vedantic theorists think that that humanity goes back millions of years. But who knows? But there's evidence of some sort of structures and building for some sort of shelter going back 1.8 million years in the Oldupai Valley, in the Oldupai Gorge. In ancient Turkey, approximately 6,500 years BC, there's a place called Katal Hayuk. There was mortared houses there. So the creation of some sort of cement that could hold things together roughly happened, people think, around 8,000 BC, at least in this iteration. And Katal Hayuk was like this massive city. Like, it was massive for the time. They thought that 6,000 people could have lived there, which is a pretty big settlement. And this is pre-agriculture, which defeats a lot of my theories saying that agriculture is what made us settle down, which is something I've expressed before. But this settlement would predate what they supposed was agriculture. I don't know. I'd have to look into it more. And this is so long ago. And nowadays, when you look at pictures, if you look it up online, it's just a whole bunch of, like, it looks like adobe huts. Like here in Colorado, we have these things called the cliff dwellings, which are like these beautiful, beautiful buildings that are built into this cliffside face. That's what this area reminds me of, but just on the other side of the world. All the houses are connected together, which is just very strange. And there was no windows. Of course, there's no glass at this time period. And there's no doors. So all the entrances to the houses were on the roofs, which were thought to be thatch. So some theorists even thought that there was no roads and that people would walk across the roofs to get around. So you'd have people walking on top of your house all day. No chimney either. There's a hole in the roof for the smoke to be able to exit. And I also found, I was reading something else about how medieval buildings, like even more recent, but even going back into prehistory, a lot of the times the animals would sleep inside the houses with the people and would be separated by like a screen. And then the body heat of the animals would help make it more survivable during times like winter times when it's very cold, you know, so the animals would sleep inside the house with the people, which I guess makes sense, you know. In the BCs, you also have evidence of tents, you know, huts, you know, you always hear about mammoth huts, like bone huts and all that kind of crap. But like I've said, roughly 3,500 to 5,000 BC is when they think agriculture comes in and starts to make headway. And with agriculture comes a whole bunch of huge, steep increases in technology and the way that people are able to conduct their lives and to sustain food and to keep food and to trade with other people. As soon as you have excess, you have the ability to be able to give more and to specialize and to be less generalized. Whereas if you're doing everything for yourself, you know, consider people out in the mountains who are, you know, building their own cabins, feeding themselves, hunting for themselves, living by themselves. You know, that's a closed loop and you don't have to trade in that situation. But what seems to happen after agriculture is you have more people settling down, more people getting excess, some people hoarding excess, retaining power. You know, there's this trend towards that that I feel has ended up in our industrialized world we have nowadays, where we have all of these huge abstract countries and societies held together by even more abstract economies. And now we have world trade, and now this world trade will always trump individual trade. That's the way I see it. So around 500-ish BC, you start to have massive like Greek architecture that you see all around Greece. You know, there's massive mega buildings going back thousands of years. You know, considering the, of course, these are memorial buildings. You know, the pyramids are funeral places, tombs. They're tombs. You know, these are places of death. So, like, a lot of these massive mega structures aren't exactly homes. These are more ceremonial places. And I could see a lot more emphasis for people to spend decades building large mega structures for ceremony and for religious purposes over peasants being able to have homes made of stone, you know. However, ancient Greece, you start to see a huge, like, especially during the time period between 400 and 300 BCE, in classical Greece, you see a lot of just almost, I don't want to say a renaissance, of technology and art and culture, and everything seems to take off. And I haven't visited Athens or been to Greece. I would love to go, but these were large cities, you know, and a lot of them were made out of stone and marble. And it takes technology to be able to manipulate those things. And it takes people and it takes planners. And then it's a lot to do that. So by 500 BC, you have a lot of these sort of things happening in Greece and in other places. I found evidence by the first century BC, or not BC, first century AD, timber frames. So that's sort of like the houses that I have always lived in, which you have wood frames, foundations, and then you build walls onto the frames. I don't know if I'm painting a good enough picture for you to see it in your head, but good enough chance you probably live in a timber-framed home right now. And so by the first century, you have the ability to build these sort of houses. Not that everybody had them, you know, and of course, hundreds of years later, in like 800 to 1000s, you have just this explosion of buildings. And then all over the world, there's all different types of buildings, you know. I got a kick out of looking at them, you know, just looking at the different type of structures and the different types of buildings that we, it's such a human thing. It's such a human just figment put out of our imagination onto the world, because we could easily live in caves. We could easily go crawl into a cave or just live in something very basic. You know, some people sleep in their cars. God help them. Nature help them. I can't fathom sleeping in a car. I was just talking with a friend about that recently. I've never had to sleep in a car. Never had to. I've always had a home. I haven't been exactly homeless yet. You know, but sleeping in a car, that's your, yeah. I mean, mobile home's a different thing, but a car is not a home. A car is just such a, it's not a comfortable place. It's not even, there's not even much square footage in that thing. But so there's a rough history of the physical structures of homes, but it's not just the physical structure that makes a home, you know, and it's not just the geographic location that makes a home either, you know? And it brings me back to the question that I started out with in this episode, which is, what is a home? That's such a hard one to actually peg down. And it seems simple. Like, it's where I sleep at night. It's where I lay my head. It's my shelter. And those things are necessity, is to have some sort of shelter, because the forces of nature and the elements can kill us. Exposure is a real thing. And it terrifies me living in a place that gets cold, because every time it snows, you know, every time I see snow out on the ground and I know how cold it's gotten at night, I know in my heart that some people haven't made it, the people who aren't as fortunate to have walls and safety. And that's always been very important to me. Like I said, I've never been homeless. I never slept in a car. And it's always been so stressful to make sure that I do have a good shelter to go to. You know, but at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if my shelter is big or small or nice or flat or whatever. You know, I've had many shelters, but having that shelter is definitely key. It's a box that needs to be checked, certainly. You know, for me, even though some people I don't think need it, there's a quadrillion ways to live, and there's a myriad of life on this planet. So my way is not the only way. But I do know what works for me and what I can and can't handle. And I prefer shelter. But capital H home isn't just shelter. And like Pliny the Elder said, home is where the heart is. Where do I lay my heart at night? When I'm out working, what am I working for? What am I sustaining? What am I building in my plans for the future for my family? You know, my family unit, my household, as the government papers would ask for. But my family unit is me and my son. So that's what I have to shelter. That's what I have to have a walls over. But I also invest time, energy, and love into that family unit that I have sheltered. You know, once we're safe, I put love into that space. And that's how I nurture my home, my heart. It's when you don't have access to your home. Like, I know some people are world citizens, but like when I'm away from home, even for 2 days, that homesickness, that word I remember from childhood so clearly, was on the phone with my father, "Are you homesick?" And as a child, it was always exciting. But as an adult, I feel that strongly. You know, I always yearn to go back home when I'm away from home. And often that's the people that are there. You know, I bring my son with me when we go on trips, so my family unit's the same, but I rarely live alone. And I have roommates currently that I live with, that I adore, and that I pour a lot of energy and compassion into, because they're beautiful human beings, and we go very far back. They're brothers to me. So coming home and being away from home is a lot about the people that you're away from in those time periods too. And if you're a family person, you have a larger family, and you have maybe a wife or a husband and kids, and say you have to go on work trips, and you're away from them, do you miss the walls or the people more? So often, I can't picture exactly what my walls look like, but I miss the people I'm away from dearly. And I no longer live with my extended family. My father and my sisters, they have another home outside of mine. But when a good enough time goes away from me being able to see these wonderful and wonderfully amazing and important people to me, my family, you know, I miss them dearly. And that is part of home. That's part of homesickness, is being sick for the love and the time of the people that you admire or adore. It's definitely not just the walls, but the walls are important too. So let's go on to a little lighter for a second and just segue into some linguistics, because I like looking into how words work, and I like thinking about how other people use it. And I couldn't find an origin for the word home, but pretty much every language uses the word home. So I thought we'd just go over how some other countries and other languages say it. And I looked up these pronunciations, but I might be an idiot. So I hope that if I speak your native home and it's butchered, you know, please email me. You know, my email is Brandon with an O, B-R-A-N-D-O-N, W as in walrus, V as in Victor, O, G as in giraffe, T as in time, @gmail.com. That's my name @gmail.com. You can email me anytime and we can have a discussion or any sort of talk, you know, anything that interests you and anything that you're worried about or concerned about or even proud about. I would love to have a conversation or a talk with anyone about anything. You can also find me on Facebook at The Gingerbread Man Dialogues. That's my handle. My Facebook page is called The Gingerbread Man. I put a lot of material out. I put all of my links to my audio boom is out there. I put a lot of quote images, and I'm trying to create a little space and a community for discussion and open discourse. And I'd love to have you there. You know, we're starting to get a little bit more traction. I just want people talking, and I want to talk to you. That's what's important to me. So, an Apache home is Chiricahua. Oh God, I'm terrible. Maybe I should have done this. Anyways, if you're laughing, maybe that's worth it. This is comedy. Chiricahua is home in Apache. Hebrew is Be it. In Chinese or Mandarin, it's Jia, which I really liked listening to them pronounce that one because there's a depth to their J in their I. It's like Jia. I can't do it. It's gorgeous. Italian, Spanish is Casa. I know I knew this one. Like, welcome to mi casa is something I always say, even though I can't speak a lick of Spanish. You know, I took Spanish 3 separate times in high school, in 2 different schools, and I failed it every single time. No bullshit. I am terrible with languages. I'm thrilled by thinking about other people's languages and how they depict their realities. Poetry and art in other languages is fascinating. Getting translators of certain books that are translated from other languages, you get to see how different in the flexion there is between translating, you know, but I failed Spanish 3 times. I failed German once. I failed French once. My last time that I took Spanish class, the 3rd time, I was a senior in high school. And for our final, we had to go up and speak for 5 minutes as good as we could. Like an oral test. Like, hey, blah, 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 something, you know. I got up, swear to nature. I got up, my dumbass got up. And I was just like, hola. And I looked at the teacher. And she had had me before. She was like, is that it? And I was like, I'm sorry. I don't get it. Yeah, pitiful. Sorry. So casa is home in Italian or Spanish. In Russian, it's dom. Dom. So powerful. Dom. Welcome to my dom. Anyways, German is Heim. Heim. In French, it's maison. I think I'm getting that one right. I'm probably butchering the accent, but maison. Welcome to my maison. May I help you? I'm sorry. If you're a Frenchman or if you speak French, I apologize. I'm not making fun of you. So in Hindi, which is the... there's many different dialects in India, but Hindi's probably the most common one that you hear about in Western cultures. But it's Gyar. Which, of course, the pronunciation, again, that I heard the video was this wonderful woman, and it was fantastic. She did a beautiful way that they speak. One thing that I read that I remember in a social science course when I was in college was how there's about 500 sounds that a human being is capable of making when we're born. English uses, like, I think 175 of those sounds. So a baby that's babbling between the ages of year and year and a half before they really start to speak out concrete words, those babbling noises are pointed. They have a reason. Those babblings are all of the noises that a human is capable of making. And so that's actually kind of cool because it's like we have these little humans that are ignorant in a way. You know, they're blank slates, but they're just powerhouses of learning and potential. And so they are born with all the puzzle pieces for language, and they're just babbling it. And then it's through hearing and through modeling things for our children that they start to pick out the ones they're already using and making a language out of it. So there actually are other cultures' languages and other pronunciations of words and other ways that use different sounds than we use in English. Like, consider that. There are other languages, like Chinese especially, where there are sounds that they use that we do not use. You know, and there's clicks, and there's all sorts of other things that we can do with our voice boxes and this whole system that we do not use in English. And so, what I read in this course that I was taking was that the brain can actually stop being able to hear some of these sounds and stop being able to produce them, which is why when you have other people come and learn how to speak English, like, you know, you hear these weird inflections because they're trying to make noises that their brains can't do, or they have to rewrite the brain to make those noises. Same with English, going to another culture too. It's not just a one-way street. This is an ethnocentric world. But that's why some, like, it sounds so weird sometimes. And sometimes you hear languages and it sounds really choppy and but maybe you're not hearing it the way it's actually supposed to be heard if you were to be born into that culture with the equipment that can make those noises and record them and even perceive them, which I find just absolutely fascinating. Like, it just blows my mind the kind of creatures we are and how we communicate and how we use these symbols. Like, we're just these meat tubes, you know. My vocal cords are just this arrangement of like flaps that vibrate with air that I'm controlling with my meat mush inside my skull that conducts electricity in a certain way so that I can even have a sense of self, maybe. Or my sense of self is a mystical element that's piggybacking on this physical hardware, like a maestro with their fingers on the keys, whereas the brain is all of the mechanisms of the piano, whereas my soul or myself could be the one playing it. Maybe I'm the electricity. Maybe I'm the space between neurons. Maybe I'm tying myself in knots and getting confused again. So let's get into some personal shit. So I'll try to relate it. Talk about, you know, memories and feelings and stuff. Make it interesting and gooey. I like cinnamon rolls. I've lived in a lot of places. Like, too many. To the point that I don't want to go anywhere anymore. I know a lot of people that I grew up with living here in Colorado for a time who haven't ever moved from this place and are just itching to leave because they think the rest of the world is so bright and beautiful, whereas the rest of the world is just the rest of the world. We're all on this rock, you know? We can build a sense of home anywhere. Anyways, I digress. So, I was born in Tennessee, 1995, so I'm 26, coming up pretty young. I know I'm a baby. If you're an older person listening to this, don't judge me. We can still have a conversation. You can still teach me things. But I was born in Tennessee. I was always told that hillbilly, if you ask somebody, you know what a hillbilly is? Hillbilly, somebody who's born on a hill in Tennessee. So technically, I'm a hillbilly. At least that's what I was always told. So lived there until I was about 6 years old. And then my dad, we moved to Colorado for the first time. And I believe we lived in Golden, in Denver. Golden is a part of Denver. Denver's huge. It's a bunch of different towns that have all been gobbled up into this huge metropolitan area. And so we lived there, and I remember there was a snowstorm at the time. There was some sort of blizzard, you know, back in 2001, 2002-ish, because I was about 5, 6, or 7. Can't remember too clearly. And that's where my father met his wife at the time, and that's the mother of my two sisters, my two youngest sisters. And then using her mother had a condominium in Hawaii, so then we moved from there. While my father and his stepmother were on their honeymoon, we moved to Maui, Hawaii, which is a beautiful island, two volcanic mountains, volcanoes, with this huge valley in between them, just absolutely positively beautiful. The largest volcano is called Haleakala, and it's so tall that when you're up on top of it, you're above the clouds, but you're above the clouds looking all the way down to the ocean. So it's an image that's really, really unique, you know, because I have a lot of mountains I live with here in Colorado, but I'm sitting at 6,500 feet of elevation, looking up at this mountain that's at 14,000 foot elevation. So I'm only looking at 7,000 feet of mountain, and I can't see the ocean. Haleakala is like 8,000 or 9,000 feet tall, so it's above the clouds, and you could see the ocean. It looks bigger than the mountains here, and it's an island. So yeah, the elevation change is just absolutely gorgeous. On the other side of the island, there is huge redwoods and just like tropical rainforest, you know, just positively gorgeous, sugarcane, pineapple. So I lived there for about a year. I was a Haole. I have red hair. I'm a very pale man. About half of the population of the school were white tourists. The other half were native islanders. And the native population of Hawaii hates white people because how we did Hawaii was just fucked. I say we as white imperialists. I don't know why I identify myself with a group from the past that murdered, but I guess that's a human tendency. It wasn't we, it wasn't me. It could have been some of my ancestors, but they parked a boat, like a big ass, you know, cannon ship, like a 200-foot gigantic army boat with cannons. They parked it offshore of the palatial residence of the king and queen of Hawaii at the time. And they pointed these massive cannons just at these people and just sat there for a week. And they never had boats that big. The Pacific Islanders, they were amazing seafaring people, but they never built large, huge ships, which is fascinating for how they island hopped and got around the world in very small constructions. So this gigantic army schooner is terrifying. You know, they have no idea what they're even looking at. And they just park this boat there and terrify these people. And then they go on, they're like, hey, you know, we won't fight you if you'll help you write a constitution. King and queen go, okay, yeah, let's I'll do this. We'll write our own constitution. Americans go, whoa. Wait. We'll help you. You're inept. We have to make your constitution for you. You know, and so from there on out, you know, slowly we hoodwinked them into becoming a colony, and now they're a state of the United States, and there's still a lot of native people living on these islands who are very aware of all of this, and they don't consider themselves Americans, you know? And there's a lot of tension, and it was weird going to school there. Because I wasn't very well liked. I was always very goofy and nerdy and awkward anyways. But then there was this racism that I wasn't used to because of my participation in the dominant race and my typical mainland orientation. And it was very eye-opening for me to be able to see what it's like to have discrimination where you're not the majority anymore. Because there's comfort in majority. And even to the day in my adulthood, I have a massive awareness of the lack of opportunity for minority classes and minority groups anywhere. And it's fucked. Completely fucked. But anyways, I'm not bitching because of my privilege. So after Hawaii, we moved back to Colorado, and I lived in Fort Collins for a wee bit. And then we moved back to Tennessee, and I lived in this beautiful place called Mount Charlotte. Lost a bunch of teeth. From Mount Charlotte, we moved to Florida, and I lived in a place called Pensacola for a little bit, and then we moved across the bayou from Pensacola to Gulf Breeze. Gulf Breeze was an army town, and so most people were very affluent, whereas, you know, my dad made his own concrete pumping business while we were there, and we ended up very well off, but it was weird. You know, and then right across, you know, in Pensacola, it was a lot bigger, but it wasn't an army town, so you had a lot more poverty. And Pensacola and Gulf Breeze are on the panhandle of Florida. And my buddy, I had him on an interview a couple weeks back, my buddy Corey, he was from Gulf Breeze, Florida. And he had moved here recently. And so that's where we had met each other and hung out when we were children, was in the Panhandle. But you can drive 20, 30, 40 minutes to the west, and you'll be in Alabama. And, you know, Alabama is definitely podunk, if my judgmental ass can have any say in the matter. So I lived there for a couple years, and then we moved to Salida in Colorado. And then from Salida, we moved to Colorado Springs, which is where I live now. And this is when I was about in eighth grade, a couple weeks towards the end of my last year. In eighth grade, I met a really good friend of mine. And from there, most of the friends that I still know nowadays, and many of the people have spoken on the podcast, I met these people at this time period in my life when I moved to this town. When my son was born, my son's mother's family lived up in northern Colorado. And so when my son was born, I moved up there and I lived in Loveland for a little bit. And then from Loveland, I moved to Greeley because I wasn't comfortable living in that town. And so Greeley is about a 30-minute drive east of Loveland on Highway 402. And I had a wonderful home there, a couple homes. I rented a room first and then I made my own apartment. I had my own apartment up there. It was pretty cool, you know. And then from there, I got custody of my son, moved back to my dad's house, and I've had several homes here in Colorado Springs. I've lived in about 5, 6, maybe 7 different apartments here. I've had apartments with friends. I've had apartments with me and my dad. My dad's had homes. My dad has a really nice home now. I've lived there several times, which is all caught up. Now we're here, you know? All this frequent moving that I did really gave me, I think, is probably the biggest reason why I have such a subjective understanding of what home is. Because I went to 14 schools before I ever got to high school. And, you know, sometimes I would live in a place for a couple months before we'd move. I was so used to attempting to make new friends badly and not generally doing it all the time that I was isolated and I was a loner a lot of the times of my childhood. And because of that, I spent a lot of time with my books and I made friends with imaginative creatures in my head. Not in a psychopathic way, maybe. You judge. But maybe my awkwardness was just because of who I was, and maybe my awkwardness was because I never was able to put down close ties with any good group of people and ever have a good friend group. But either way, I tended towards adults. It was much easier for me to communicate with an adult than it was to communicate with any child my age. And so I was always teacher's pet, and I didn't make a lot of friends, even though I did make friends, you know. And this history of homes is part of what made me who I am. My ability to make a space. You know, I still get uncomfortable if I'm sleeping at somebody else's house for the night. You know, but if I had to move into a new home, which I'm have to soon, you know, part of why I wanted to make this episode is we're losing our home. My buddy that I live with, we're very fortunate to have the place because his mother is the one who bought it, and we pay off her mortgage to her, or part of it. And so we pay rent through that. And so it's a family arrangement. So my rent is incredibly cheap where I'm at right now. And we've been here for a couple years. My son has his own room, and I put a lot of love and a lot of attention and a lot of effort into this place. I love this place, you know? And I've been in the action of trying to locate a new place, and my buddies are moving. And so I'm losing people I can depend on, and I have to go make my own home by myself with chagrin because I don't want to. I would much rather live with somebody else, you know? And so it's this I'm pitying myself in a way, I guess, but I'm competent and I'm looking for a new home. And when I get into that new space, within a week, I will feel at home once I put my energy into it. And that flexibility is because of my past and because of my history and because of all the different places that I've been. And I could be grateful for that, or I could pity myself. You tell me which one is the smarter move. So what made me feel at home? I think I've already talked about some of this, but a lot of it was having my dad. My dad did a wonderful job of making me feel loved, making me feel that I was his son, you know. Looking back at my childhood and all of his efforts, I sometimes feel guilty and think that I am not as good as my father was. I'm trying. I could do better always. And he says that I do a good job, which makes me feel good if he thinks I do a good job. But, you know, my dad, he made me feel at home. You know, he made that feeling that I had something to come home to. Even when he got involved and had kids, you know, I was always my dad's son. So that's what made me feel at home. You know, and having my hobbies and knowing my interests, having my books, that made me feel at home. You know, I wish I could have been more introspective and not been so obsessed with distracting myself as a child. I would have had more spaces of home within myself, because we make a space of home inside too. There is a space inside me. I was thinking about this earlier, because right before I sat down to do this show, this is a second take because, you know, me and my son have been arguing all day. You know, I've been short with him. And so I needed a little bit of space before I did this so that I didn't get on all angry and fucking pissed off. Because as soon as I get mad, my brain shuts down and I can't think straight anymore. And all of my ideas aren't very good anymore. I wonder if you can relate. So I sat down and I meditated before I did the show just to get some perspective and try to get some calm. And within 2 or 3 minutes of some good deep breathing, I noticed that space within myself. And it was funny because of all these thoughts that I've been doing on this episode and how I wanted to depict this. And I'm just sitting, I'm like, wow, this space right here inside me with my eyes closed while I'm breathing, that is a space of home too. And that's a home I did not have when I was younger, because I never felt comfortable inside my own skin. And as an adult, I have been learning how to craft that home within me. You know, there's a home outside of me, but there's a home within me. There's a home that my soul resides in. Even if it is unextended and immaterial, my soul resides in me. Maybe in all of me, but if I don't keep that space that it's residing in, if I don't keep me clean, you know, that's kind of sad. Some of the best homes that I've had, you know, Hawaii was cool. We had a condo there. It was small. I had a pull-out couch with a bed in it, and I slept in the living room. That's how small it was. And my mom and, or my dad and his wife at the time, they had their own room. And you'd walk out the condo and it was set up kind of like a hotel almost, you know, like, so like just rooms and walks and stairs. And there was a nice pool, which was just hilarious because the pool is there about 30 feet away from the ocean. Like anybody would choose the pool over the ocean, which, yeah. So yeah, you walk out and like literally 40, 50 feet away from my front door was the ocean. And there was several, there was no coral on the beach where we were at, because they would blast the coral. They'd blow it up to make sand. And then they'd use that sand to build beaches for people to sit on, which is just ludicrous. But you'd go to undeveloped parts. Like you'd go next door to the just off of the condo property, where there is not a really good, well-established beach. You'd swim out there and you would immediately find coral. You know, so I saw urchins, I saw conch shells, I saw sea turtles. It, just absolutely beautiful place. And I could, anytime I got home, I could just go out there. I did a lot of boogie boarding. I don't know if you know what boogie boarding is. Boogie boarding is like, it's like a short board that's made out of styrofoam so it doesn't go down, and you lay on it and you surf with your chest, kind of. Did a lot of that, you know. Just I have fond memories of there. You know, there was a girl there that I was obsessed with. You know, I had a massive crush on her even though I was so young. You know, and we'd do these games. We'd play house, and I would like pretend she was like my wife because I was already a little romantic even in my childhood. It's so embarrassing. You know, in Florida, I always get confused because there was two houses. I remember there was one house that had a canal behind it, and then there was another house that had a bunch of woods. And I always get confused because I thought the canal house was the one where I had my neighbors, but we also played in the woods behind our house. And if there was a canal, there would have been a canal behind my friend's house too. So I get them blended. This is what happens. This was weird with memories, you know, so don't always trust your memories. But there's this one house that had this just beautiful canal behind it and a dock, and it was just gorgeous. You know, and then the other house, there was woods, and me and my friends would go out and just build stuff back there. We'd build forts. We'd camped out there. And then the road in front of our house, you could walk down it like about 2-3 blocks. And then there was a pier and then a big old stretch of water that you could go swim on and that we'd go fish on. Before I moved, that was one of the last places that me and my friends went. I had a sleepover, and I have a picture with all of my friends that was a going-away party. And I remember sitting out there on that dock with everybody and talking about the future. I remember it so clearly. It was such an important moment. And I remember fishing on that dock with my buddy. I had a friend named Zach. He was a great guy. And one day he puts his hook out, and he's just fighting with this thing for hours. And this old man comes up and is like, "Kid, you better give up. You got a rock there." You know, and I'm just like, and he's so stubborn. He's like, "It's not a rock, sir." And so he just keeps fighting and fighting and fighting. And this hours into it, he pulls up this thing, and it's like a 5-foot wide stingray. Just this massive stingray. You know, cut the line, because it's not like he can eat the fucker. It's actually kind of dangerous. You know, same kid, I remember. It would have these torrential rains every single day at 7 o'clock on the money every day. And it would flood the roads, and it'd be like the water would come down at like 85, 95 degrees. So it'd be like you were soaked in a hot tub. And he would ride his surfboard down to my house because there'd be so much water on the road. He could just surf to my house. Yeah, that's a real story. Yeah, it's just, yeah. Good memories. It's another thing about homes. It's a junction point. It's a concrete anchor for memory. For me, always, is that when I start to think back to certain places that I've called home or I've made home, you get inundated and flooded with memories when you start to poke that space of memory. Tennessee, I remember the Charlottetown, Mount Charlotte. We had a big old property there. It was a huge, beautiful house. It was old. I remember I thought it was haunted. My dad built out like a plot and built a bunch of like farm and stuff. I remember we had jalapenos that year that were so hot that people couldn't even eat them. You know, my dad was kind of happy, and we had this huge field, and there was a cherry blossom tree, and I'd climb this cherry blossom tree, and I would sit underneath it, and I could see it in my head now still, just beautiful pink fucking leaves. And just hundreds of wild onions, giant clovers, just big old white puff balls of dandelion flowers. And I would walk, I'd get off on the bus from school. I was probably in third or fourth grade. And I'd get off the bus. It was like really a rural area. And I would walk along this train track that was next to the road for like a mile. And then I would hop over the train track and then walk to my parents' house. And I remember one day I lost like 3 teeth all in the same day, you know, lost 2 at school. And then I was wiggling another one on the way home on the train tracks and just pulled another one out. And I was so excited when I got home, you know, because I just gotten all these fucking teeth out. Right. And I just knew I was going to get like $50, you know, maybe like 75 cents, but still, I was just so excited. And I remember another time, I thought the place was haunted. My dad always told me there nobody died here. You know, who do you know who's died here? And like, there's no ghosts. And I was sitting there one night, and I start hearing scrabbling in the walls, freaking the fuck out. Wake up my parents. My dad ends up climbing up into the attic that next day, finds a family of raccoons in the wall. You know, and these coons, there was like a mama coon and like 5 or 6 of her babies. And you know, that's dangerous. You can't fuck with a mama coon. Like they're larger animals, and they're fierce. And they're scary, you know? And so my dad ended up helping get the coons out. And, you know, we had it was just really hilarious. And finally got Animal Protective Services. They all got safe and hopefully relocated. Another time, I think my dad brought home a baby deer, like literally like a newborn baby deer. And because it didn't have a mama or something. And so we had to get animal services for this thing too, but I remember walking it. It was walking around the house with its wobbly little knees. It was just so small, so little. You know, so that was a pretty place. You know, and then Colorado in my teens, you know, I remember all those apartments. I started to get a lot of individuality and solidarity when my dad left his wife at the beginning of my high school career. You know, it was just me and him, and he was fighting for custody and trying to work. And it was so rough. We went from being pretty well off-ish to, you know, me and my dad were homeless for a little bit. And, you know, sleeping on friends' couches and futons. And when the places we were living at ended up being more low-end apartments. And it gave me some humility. You know, my dad was never happy living in these spaces because he always thought he was better than that, which he is. But for me, I don't ever need much, and I could be happy in an apartment. You know, and so I look back at these apartments fondly. And even in my searches now, a lot of the places that I go to first to try to apply to that I'm trying to get in now, I'm looking at the old apartments I used to live at when I was a kid. You know, within the nostalgia, you know, it's attractive to me. It's appealing to me to want to go back to some of these places. You know, I would be happy there. You know, and a lot of that's because of the memories and these concepts of home that I built when I was a teenager. You know, living up in Greeley, you know, I was very fond of that too, because it was the first time I ever had my own home. And this is kind of what I'm moving into now, is I'm trying to build a new one now that's going to be my own with no roommates and no backup. And I haven't done that since Greeley when I had that own place, but I didn't have any love and no family then. So it's just, it's scary and it's new. It's novel. You know, when I first moved up there, me and my son's mother were together. So we had this weird little family. And her mother had a house out there. There was this little tiny shack of a place, you know, very small, broken window. And within 2 weeks, you know, she left and took my son. And I kind of like, I didn't have anywhere to go. So I kept sleeping there, even though it wasn't mine. And they gave me like a month, and like 2 weeks in, they shut off the power, you know? And so then I got out of there and I found a room in Greeley and lived with two good people. You know, I was kind of at odds with one of them, but from there, I lived there for a couple months, maybe 5-6 months. And then I got my own apartment and moved in to, I think it was like 2020 10th Street. Yeah. Something like that. And it was this old Victorian farmhouse, like my staircase that you'd walk up to when you look at the two doors. It's like the central staircase you see going up to a balcony for an old farmhouse, if that makes any sense. Like, you know, you walk into the building and there's the chandelier hanging in the big open space, and then there's the two staircase, the big staircase in the middle that goes up and then it branches. Like, imagine that with a wall down the center, and then my apartment was half of the top upstairs landing. It was very bizarre. The house was so old that there wasn't an internet jack, so I had no way to run internet into my house. So when I got the internet company to come there, he had to build a box and put a box all the way from the power box two blocks away, and then run an internet line underneath the grass up my wall and put the internet box outside my window. So I plug my modem inside the house and the wire would go outside of the house and be plugged in outside my house. It's fucking bizarre, but it was mine. You know, I was very proud of it, you know? And when I got my son, when I had to give up that little spot, it was kind of sad. I had built it all myself with my own efforts and my own time. But we do it over and over and over again. We build efforts. We can do it many times over. It's not just once. And we have to have faith that there's a point to dropping something that we gave effort into to go make something new, because it could be beautiful. You know? So those are some homes that of my past. Some gushy feelings and some memories. I don't know how much of that's entertaining, but I hope that it helped in some way. So why am I doing this? Why am I talking about homes? How do we make a home? You know, is it just about buying a home? Is that how we make one? Is it the moving truck? Is that what makes a home? Is it the stress? Is it the love that makes a home? Think about it. How do you make a home for yourself? Have you already done it? Do you have to go make a home for yourself soon? Do you have to go make a new home like me? How does a community make a home? How important is family to home? Does a home have to have a family? Can we make a home if we're by ourselves, if we're just an individual? Can we make a family by ourselves? What if we have pets? What if I was a solitary person and I might have a puppy still? You know, anything to give love to, you know? When we clean our homes and we make our homes nice, we kind of give love to our home, you know? How about the city? How about the community, like a neighborhood? How does a neighborhood make a home? You know, have you ever lived in a really good neighborhood where you knew your neighbors and everybody was so kind? Or do you have any family members, or have you ever lived in a rural area where you know everybody in town? Isn't that special when you know the guy at the gas station, or know the woman at the gas station, or know the kids next door in an uncreepy way? Or how important is the people around you that aren't even inside your own walls? Are the walls of other people part of your own home if you can extend it out enough or make enough space inside you to incorporate the love for somebody else's walls? What breaks a home? You know, violence or finance? Being poor, losing a home. Novelty, change, new settings, cataclysm, catastrophe. You lose your job because you get laid off and it's not even your fault, and all of a sudden you can't afford anything anymore. Financial catastrophe, you know, fear, terror, anxiety. Does that break a home? Do you really lose a home when you have to leave the walls that you're in right now? Violence. You could have walls and you could be mean and hateful to all the people in your life. Are you giving love to the people in your life? Or are you hurting them? If you're hurting the people in your life, if you're hurting the people in your family, if you're hurting the people that live within the walls that you share with them, does that violence break the home? Even if you have walls, do you have a home anymore? How can we make a better home? Presence, our sponsor today. Being in it, not distracting ourselves, loving the people and the space, keeping it clean and lovely and nice, giving compassion and care to those that are important to you that are within your home or family, or giving compassion and care and love to yourself if you live by yourself and you're individually a family. And can you have a home that moves? Can you have walls on wheels? I mean, I obviously don't want to sleep in my car, but some people can. Maybe you have a van. Vans are kind of cool. You can make the back of the space out into something. Kind of like, I always think of That 70s Show. But all silliness aside, one of the things that I've been thinking about, one of my 5-year plans, my one of my spiritual teachers in my life, a guy that teaches my kung fu class and that I see many times a week and that I have a lot of respect for, my teacher, he offered space of land that he owns for me if I can get something to put on it, you know, which I was looking at mobile homes, you know, 2 to 3 bedroom trailers. You can get that for $7,000, which is as much as I paid for my car. So if I bought in a trailer instead of my car, you know, which it's a plan and I can't do it right now. And I felt bad because I told him, I was like, there's physically nothing I could do in this time frame right now to make this happen. But if you can keep that offer in your back pocket for me, it's something that I could consider doing. You know, and I'm going to work on trying to get a mobile home. It's cheaper. A lot of people are house poor right now because renting is just galvanizing. It's extortion. Renting, especially in my state right now, is so hard. I'm looking for 2-bedroom apartments, you have to make 2.5 times rent to even apply for them. I'm very low income because I'm a cook. And I know we talked about it on the episode Honest Work. Cooks are the most underpaid people in our country. Like literally when I type in lowest paying jobs, it was the lowest paid job that showed up on Google. And so on my income, the cheapest 2-bedroom apartment in the ghetto, which is 1,000, I need to make at least 2,500. Low income, I make barely 1,900. You know, not to openly talk about my finances on this space, but, you know, if I can somehow get somebody to let me go through the application, which people aren't even letting me apply right now, you know, when I get into that space, more than 2/3 of my income is going to rent, you know, not even before my car payments and all the other bullshit. So having a mobile home and owning it gives a lot of power because lot rent is a lot cheaper. You know, my teacher's offering me space for basically free. I could be a lot better off if I can get into that kind of home. And then once my son is grown and born, I could potentially just take my home and leave. You know, I could go anywhere. I could tow my home. I could move my home. You know, it's something that I was hesitant at first against, but it's something that is beginning to sound better and better to me the more I think about it. And it's definitely something I think I can work for. And I know a lot of other people who are in similar mindsets to me, sick of being house poor and thinking about this sort of stuff too. You know, maybe it'll work. But yeah. I hope this was helpful. I'm going to start wrapping it up here. You know, the main points. What are the main points? Home. It's not just the walls. You make home. You can carry home with you to work. Home is a feeling. Home is a space we make inside ourselves, and it's a space we fill up outside of ourselves. Home is the family. Home is the people you love. You can be grateful for home. I am grateful for my home. I'm grateful for my walls. I'm grateful for the fact that I could take a shower. I'm grateful that I have a beautiful bed and a room that I can close my door and be alone. I'm grateful for all of the memories and the time I've spent here. I'm grateful for my friends giving me this opportunity. I'm grateful. I'm so, so grateful for all of the times that I've loved here, because I've loved so much here. And I put so much energy and so much feeling into these walls, into the space that I, at this moment, call home, but will soon be a memory of home that I can speak about at another time period. Let's see what the Tao has to say about home. So this is from Ursula K. Le Guin's Tao. She's the translator. She is an author of several wonderful books, including, I think it's the Earthsea Cycle series. Yep. I guess she died recently. That sucks. She's an internationally celebrated author of more than 50 books of fiction, poetry, and essays, including The Left Hand of Darkness, Always Coming Home, and the Earthsea Cycle series. Her numerous literature awards include 6 Nebula Awards, 7 Hugos, blah, 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 blah. So she's super big author person, and so when I started putting out excerpts of her verses, her translations, a lot of the people were surprised that she was in the sacred text department, because she was more of a fiction writer. But I guess she has a huge influence of occultism and spirituality, including, you know, Taoism. And so she had some sort of relationship with some other teacher guy who helped her do this, I think. So, I know I've done this verse before, but it still pertains. All right? Here we go. Chapter 11. The uses of not. 30 spokes meet in the hub. Where the wheel isn't is where it's useful. Hollowed out, clay makes a pot. Where the pot's not is where it's useful. Cut doors and windows to make a room. Where the room isn't, there's a room for you. So the prophet and what is in the use of what isn't. And I always like her little commentaries. At the bottom of the page, her commentary was, "One of the things I love about Lao Tzu is that he is so funny. He's explaining a profound and difficult truth here, one of those counterintuitive truths that when the mind can accept them, suddenly double the size of the universe. He goes about it with his deadpan simplicity, talking about pots." So the reason I wanted to read this verse again is because of the second part of it, where it says, cut doors and windows to make a room where the room isn't, there's a room for you. I've seen other versions of that verse where instead of room, they've used the word home. A home is useful because of the space inside. It's because of what we put in it. You know, a vase isn't useful because it's a vase. A vase is useful because it can hold so many different materials. And so you have to transport things. You can't transport things. You can't hold water in your hands. You need that vase to hold water. And there are ideas that are symbolic and analogous to water that we can't carry. And that's the need to have these spaces that we acknowledge in these vesicles, such as our home. The space within a home, it's the effort, it's the feeling, it's the love. Like I've said a million times, I know it's simple. But I know it's simple. Just think about it. Chapter 47. You don't have to go out the door to know what goes on in the world. You don't have to look out the window to see the way of heaven. The farther you go, the less you know. So the wise soul doesn't go, but knows, doesn't look, but sees, doesn't do, but gets it done. We tend to expect great things from seeing the world and getting experience. A Roman poet remarked that travelers change their sky, but not their soul. Other poets, untraveled and inexperienced, Emily Bronte and Emily Dickinson, prove Lao Tzu's point. It's the inner eye that really sees the world. I saw this again. I've seen this in several different angles, but today this was yet again a commentary on the home for me. You know, we can expect to go make home simply by leaving our doors, metaphorically putting our comforts outside of our inner spaces. But sometimes respecting the space that we have is how we can cultivate home. I don't know if that makes any sense. Hope it does. I want to do one more verse that I don't really think. Yeah, we'll do this one. Chapter 54. Some rules. Well planted is not uprooted. Well kept is not lost. The offerings of the generations to the ancestors will not cease. To follow the way yourself is real power. To follow it in the family is abundant power. To follow it in the community is steady power. To follow it in the whole country is lasting power. To follow it in the world is universal power. So in myself, I see what self is. In my household, I see what family is. In my town, I see what community is. In my nation, I see what a country is. In the world, I see what is under heaven. How do I know the world is so? By this. Yet again, for me, this is a commentary on how important it is to build home within ourselves first, these layers of an onion. Then we paint home within our rooms. Then we paint home outside of our rooms, in our communities, in our neighborhoods. And then eventually, when we can make our hearts big enough, we can paint home onto the world and see the world as our home, because it is. This planet, nature, every single bit of life is your neighbor and is part of your extended family. At least it is for me. And I love every beautiful speck, all the wind, all the amazing things and beautiful music and tasty morsels and scrumptious smells that I can't sense because I had COVID, and tactile feelings that send shivers up my spine, and tantalating conversations with amazing people that make my mind bend and my soul weep. Hopefully we can have some conversations like that, if you're willing. Thank you so much. I am so grateful for you listening. We're coming up to the end here. I'm going to end out with my new favorite segment with my correspondent, Captain O, and the new and amazing Ask O. I hope you enjoyed it. Last solitary episode I did, he's an amazing little boy, and I think he has an amazing opinion, and we're going to see what he has to say about what home is. But before we do that, thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you, thank you. I'm so grateful for your ears. I'm so grateful for your mind. I'm so grateful that you're breathing right now, and that whatever you're doing, you have an impact. You are valuable. You are seen. People love you. And hopefully, you have avenues and abilities to give your love to other people too. Remember what it is you're fighting for. Love yourself. Love your children. Love your family. Love your friends. Love a stranger. Love the species. And love every single bit of speck, even the microorganism and the fruit fly on that apple. Thank you so much, and I hope you have a wonderful week. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Ask O. How you doing, O?
I'm doing good. I am Captain... You know Halloween. You guys are all this wine because we still have a month to Halloween. Do you know that?
Odin's pretty mad because he thinks Halloween's always the next day. And so every time I tell him it's still a couple days away, he's not very happy with me. But that's okay.
It's still a month.
Yep. You're all suited up, aren't you?
Yes.
Can you tell everybody what you are?
I am a knight for Halloween.
Describe your outfit. What does it look like?
So, my outfit has a sword and by the way, this, wait, what? I forgot. I've lost my helmet.
We'll find it. That's okay, huh?
Yeah.
So here's my question for you today, bud. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. What is home?
Home is your home. Kids are supposed to be at home because it has food, water, washing machines. That's home.
That's what makes home?
Yes. Bricks make home.
Bricks?
No. Bits.
What is that?
Nothing.
What else makes a home?
I don't know.
Is a home where you can relax?
Yes, it's home where you get to relax. And by the way, let me introduce my sword. Hello, my name is Sword, and that's it, yo bro.
That's hilarious. That's pretty funny. What other things can you do at home? Is home where you hang out with your family?
Home's where you hang out with your family, also.
Don't touch that, Bubba. What else?
I don't know what else.
What's your favorite part about home?
My favorite part is toys.
Your toys?
Yes, my toys.
Being able to play and be creative?
Yes.
Okay.
Already. Whoa, there you go.
It's this way, buddy.
No.
All right. Anything else you want to say before we end?
No.
Okay. I love you, buddy.
I love you.
Thank you for your time. You want to say bye?
Bye-bye.